The European Union was created in order to try to unite Europe. In one professor, John Laughlin from America, he explains the background to the European Union. And he says this: people were keen to recover this lost unity, which dated back to before the fragmented days of the individual nation states, to previous unions, and even to the Roman Empire. However, it was not until after World War II that a European Union became a realistic prospect. Rather than focusing on trying to find a shared ideology, the reason behind much of the earlier conflict, politicians saw economic unity as a way of preventing future clashes. So what this professor was saying is basically that there is something about unity that drives people in Europe and politicians in Europe. They want to see a united Europe. Just like America, you have the United States of America. Some people want to create a United States of Europe. And this is not a new thing. This is something that people have tried for millennia, you could say even. Ever since the fall of the Roman Empire, people have tried to get back, to regain this lost unity, is what this professor was saying. And through the European Union, this became a possible reality. They've tried to unite it in many other ways, but the difference with the European Union is that they're trying to unite it not ideologically, but financially, economically. And in this way, they seem to be getting quite close. But the European Union has had its shaky times, especially lately. We see the financial crisis in 2008, which really split, or almost split, the European Union. Then we had, last year, an actual crack. We had the Brexit, which made one of the greatest members of the European Union leave. And so the Guardian says the decision in favor of Brexit following a bitterly close electoral race represents the biggest shock to the political establishment in Britain and across Europe for decades. Why is it so hard to unite Europe? Why is it that people have tried so hard for hundreds of years, even thousands of years, to try to recreate fallen Roman Empire, but they cannot succeed? Now, there might be many answers to that question. But one of the key answers in my mind, and something which may be shocking to some people, is that there is actually a prophecy about Europe in the Bible that was written 2,600 years ago, which speaks of these events. And Brexit is a partial fulfillment, actually, of this prophecy. Now, you might think I'm just a crazy fanatic, but listen carefully to this presentation, and you tell me afterwards what I am. Let me share with you a story. How many of you have seen Hacksaw Ridge? Yeah? That was about some lunatic Christian person that was a conscientious objector. He didn't want to take life. He was quite admirable. He was very firm to his conviction. Now, he was keeping the Sabbath. He wasn't eating meat. He was doing all these other strange things, maybe. But he didn't want to take life. But he still believed in the cause of the war. So he became a conscientious objector. He tried to, and he saved 75 people's lives, even though he never carried a gun. And he was awarded the Medal of Honor. Now, that was an American. Another person that actually belonged to the same group, the same church, was another man called Franz Hassel, on the other side of the war. he was on Germany's side. He was a pastor from Germany. He was also a conscientious objector. However, there was no place for a conscientious objector in Nazi Germany. So what happened? Well, he joined, and he threw away his gun that he held. He was actually an engineer soldier on the front lines of the German assault. And they were going into Russia when they were fighting the Russians to take the oil at the Baku area. But what he did was he threw away his gun into the sea, and then he took a wooden handle, and he carved a wooden handle that looked like a gun, and he put that in his belt so that he looked like he was armed, but in fact he wasn't. So anyway, Franz Hassel was one day called in. Like many times, he was behind enemy lines, and he saw a lot of his comrades fall. Actually, out of his whole battalion, there were only seven people that survived, and he was one of them. And he claimed the promises of God many times in this battle. And there's a book written about him called "A Thousand Shall Fall," which comes from one of those texts that he claimed. And he writes in this book about a man, or about a situation where he meets his officer. His officer calls him in one day and tells him, "Why are you?" He asks him a straight question. He asks, "Do you believe that Germany will win the war?" Now, as a patriotic soldier, he was of course expected to answer, "Yes, of course." But since he was a pastor, he had also studied this prophecy that we will look at. And he could not conscientiously say that Hitler would succeed in uniting Europe, even though it looked like it at that time. And so he didn't know what to actually say, so he sent a prayer to God at that moment, and then he got the thought that came to him, and he told his officer, "Is this an official or an unofficial question?" And the officer was thinking a bit, and then he took off his hat, which was the signal that now it's an unofficial, you can speak freely, it's not an official question. So he took off his hat, and he said, "Okay, it's unofficial." And Franz Hassel picked up his little pocket Bible, he opened to Daniel chapter 2, he gave him a Bible study on this prophecy, and this officer was very impressed with this. He said, can I keep the Bible? But I want you to be back here at 9 o'clock tomorrow." So, okay, the officer kept the Bible. Franz Hassel went out. He came back the next morning. And there were all of the officers, or some other officers, also waiting for him. And he thought that this was a trap. But then this officer took off his hat. And he said, and the other officers did the same. Then he said, "Can you give us again this Bible study that you gave?" And so Franz Hassel picked up his Bible again, and he gave this Bible study. And I'll show you right now this study. It happened in ancient Babylon in 605 BC. The Neo-Babylonian kingdom under Nebuchadnezzar II conquered Jerusalem and brought a lot of captives to Babylon. And in Nebuchadnezzar's second year of reign, he had a dream. And perhaps you don't have a Bible with you, you might have it on your phone, but I'll read to you what it says here in Daniel chapter 2. It says, "Now in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was so troubled that his sleep left him. Then the king gave the command to call the magicians, the astrologers, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans to tell the king his dream. So they came and stood before the king." Now, have you ever had a dream that you were really impressed about? Really impressed with? Some dream that really, you know, made a very vivid impression on you. And have you ever had that dream and then you think that this is, I'll never forget it, and then half an hour later it's gone? Has that happened to you ever? I don't know. It has happened to me many times. It's amazing. You think that this dream, I'll never be able to forget it, but you actually do. This is what happened to Nebuchadnezzar. He had this dream, and he thought, this is a very important dream. I don't know what it means, but let me call all of my wise men of Babylon, all my astrologers, all my magicians, and all these people, that they will tell me what I dreamt. And so they came, and they stood before the king, and we'll see what happens. And the king said to them, I've had a dream, and my spirit is anxious to know the dream. Then the Chaldean spoke to the king in Aramaic, O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will give the interpretation. The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, My decision is firm. If you do not make known the dream to me and its interpretation, you shall be cut in pieces, and your houses shall be made an ash heap. Now this king had quite a hot temper, and he was impatient. Maybe the impatience was due to himself forgetting the dream, you know. He called all of these people in, and then suddenly he forgot about the dream. And so he wants them to tell him. Well, these people, remember, they claim to have supernatural powers. So they had connection with the gods, so to speak. They had magical powers, so to speak. So there would be no problem in his mind for them to tell him what he dreamt, if the gods had talked to him. So, but they can't. They argue back and forth for a while, and eventually the king becomes so upset, so angry, that he decides to destroy all of the wise men of Babylon. He realizes that he has a bunch of phonies on the royal payroll, and he's not happy about that. So he decides to kill them all. Now, there is one person in this story that we haven't talked about, and his name is Daniel. Has anyone of you ever heard of Daniel in the lion's den? You know, the stories, maybe, that are quite famous. Daniel was a Hebrew boy, and he was taken captive when the Babylonians conquered Jerusalem. And he and his friends were there, but they were not just captives, they were even put in the Babylonian schools. And so they became the learned, or the wise men of Babylon. Now, usually that might be a good thing, but in this case it was a bad thing, because Nebuchadnezzar had decided to kill all of the wise men of Babylon, including Daniel, even though Daniel was not there at this moment. So there's a big crisis going on. So what's going to happen? Well, the king's guard comes and knocks at Daniel's door one day, and Daniel opens and says, Hi, what can I do for you? And the guard says, I've come to kill you. Oh, Daniel says, Why? What's happening? And he explained the whole situation to him. And then Daniel tells the king's guard that, let me go before the king and let me ask him for some time. And he goes in before the king and he asks for some time. He says to the king, I'll give you what you ask for. I'll tell you your dream and I'll tell you the interpretation if you just give me a little bit of time. And Nebuchadnezzar says, okay. And I don't know what you would have done if you had a few days or something to come up with a crazy king's dream. Otherwise, your head would be chopped off. But Daniel did something quite impressive. He prayed. In Daniel 2, verse 17, it says, Then Daniel went into his house and made the decision known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, that they might seek the mercies from the God of heaven concerning this secret, so that Daniel and his companions might not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Then the secret was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. So Daniel blessed the God of heaven. That's interesting. He prayed to God, and he received an answer to his prayer. He goes then in before the king, and he tells him confidently what he has dreamt, what he has dreamt. In verse 26, it says, The king answered and said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar. They tried to change their names so that they would, you know, brainwash them into the Babylonian religion instead of the one they had from their birth. Are you able to make known to me the dream which I have seen and its interpretation? Verse 27 says, Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, The decree which the king has demanded, the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, the soothsayers,
cannot declare to the king. But there is a God in heaven who reveals secrets, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. Your dream and the visions of your head upon your bed were these." So Daniel goes in and he's confident about this, and this is what he dreamt. "You, O king," verse 31, "were watching, and behold, a great image. This great image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. This image's head was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze. Its legs were of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. You watched while a stone was cut out without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were crushed together, and it became like chaff from the summer threshing floor. The wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found, and of the stone that struck the image, it became a great mountain and filled the whole earth." Quite an impressive dream, wasn't it? Now, what in the world does this mean? Remember, the king didn't only want to know what he dreamt. He wanted to know what does it mean to. But I'm sure at this time, Nebuchadnezzar is quite impressed. I mean, his jaw is probably dropping and he's sitting on the edge of his seat wondering what is going to happen. Yeah, that's right. That's the one I saw. How did you know? Well, God revealed it to me. What does it mean then? Now, what does it mean? Sometimes in Bible prophecy, people get a bit, sensational. You know, they pick a little thing here and there, and then they make an interpretation that sounds nice and sweet, and then they say, this was a prophecy, and look, it's fulfilled. Now, that's not a serious Bible study. That's not the way we ought to do. If we want to know exactly what this means, let me just give you some examples. Let's say, for example, what does this one mean? Okay, I can say this one, you have gold, silver, bronze. Come on, what can this mean? Well, this is metals, okay, precious metals. Maybe it's money. It's talking about money, right? Oh, it must be a big collapse. Maybe the financial crisis. You know, it's a good interpretation, right? Would you buy it? Well, maybe someone says that, no, Jonathan, that was not a good interpretation. This is actually, you know, gold, silver, bronze, that's the Olympic medals. And you know, if you have there's going to happen a big thing at the Olympic Games. Maybe there's a meteorite going to crash into the Olympic arena. Ah, now you have two different interpretations. And someone else says that, no, that's not what it means. This is a foreboding of a dangerous disease. And these are the symptoms of the dangerous disease. And so that's what this is predicting. Now we have three completely different interpretations. Now, how in the world can we know which interpretation is true? And let me be honest with you. The reason that there are, or has anyone ever found it strange or confusing that there are many different churches out there teaching different things? If it was so that the Bible was what it claimed to be, why are there so many interpretations? The reason is that people do not allow the Bible to interpret itself. They come up with their own interpretation, like I just did with this, and then they start their own religion based on things like that. The only way that we can find out what the Bible actually is saying is to interpret it on its own terms, to allow it to speak for itself. And fortunately, Daniel continues and he gives the explanation. So let's find out. Daniel chapter 2, verse 37 to 40. Or 36 says, "This is the dream. Now we will tell the interpretation of it before the king." So here's the interpretation, according to the Bible itself. "You, O king, are the king of kings. For the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. And wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field and the birds of the heaven, he has given them into your hand, and has made you ruler over them all, you are this head of gold. But after you shall arise another kingdom inferior to yours, then another, a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters everything, and like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others.
All right. So this was not the Olympic medals, right? This is not a financial crash. What do all these metals represent? Well, you tell me. What do they represent? I don't want to make the interpretations. It's kingdoms, right? Different kingdoms. And that's what it says, at least. So, and whose kingdom does it start with? I mean, this is not rocket science. It starts with Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom. Daniel said, "You, O king, are this head of gold." So we can know for sure that the Babylonian kingdom was this head of gold. But then there would come another kingdom, and then there would be a third kingdom, and then there would be a fourth kingdom, and so on. Now, well, let's study this a little bit. The Babylonian Empire ruled from 605 to 539 BC, and it was the world-dominating power. Now, when you look at the map like this, it doesn't look very big. However, if you think about the then-known world, there was no competitor to Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar had conquered Egypt, he had conquered all of the other nations around here, and you can see, if you go to a British museum, for example, you can see these archaeological findings where you have the Babylonian world map. It's a circle, and in the center you have Babylon, and then you have Jerusalem in the east, and so on, different other realms. So this is the world according to the Babylonians and according to Daniel in Daniel's time. Now the Babylonians was quite an impressive empire. Has anyone ever been to the Pergamon Museum in Berlin? No? You should go sometime. They have this is my wife right there underneath this arch, and you see this arch is actually the Ishtar Gate. It is a beautiful piece of art that was the main entrance for the Babylonian kingdom. And Nebuchadnezzar II, he was a real actual person. You can find archaeological findings of him. Here's Nebuchadnezzar II's clay cylinder. He's not an imaginary person in the British Museum. And you can, it was a big empire in these days. But Babylon was, or especially Nebuchadnezzar, was obsessed with the thought that Babylon should exist forever, it should endure forever, it should rule the world forever. But it would not. According to the prophecy, there would be another kingdom that would come. So I'm sure Nebuchadnezzar was very happy with the first comments, that you are the head of gold. But then when Daniel says, but there will be another kingdom, that was not very nice for him. He didn't like that one bit. And we can see that in the next chapter when he builds a statue entirely of gold, because he wants to see that my kingdom should rule forever. Anyway, Daniel chapter 2, verse 39 says, after you shall arise another kingdom inferior to yours. And those of you who know history, you know that Babylon today is not a world empire. It fell. And who conquered it? Well, it was the Medo-Persians, the Medo-Persian Empire. It was so that Cyrus the Great, have you heard of Cyrus the Great? Cyrus the Great, he came from Persia. He united two tribes, Iranian tribes, the Medes and the Persians, and they besieged Babylon. And the Babylonians were quite safe, though. Here's a Greek historian. He says that when Cyrus' men were employed at building the siege works, the enemy upon the wall, they laughed the siege works to scorn in the belief that they had provisions enough for more than 20 years. So they had no fears whatsoever about Cyrus conquering Babylon. So they threw a big party. And they left the Well, what happened was that Cyrus, he diverted the river Euphrates that flowed straight through Babylon so that his army could march under the walls just at this time of the big party that they had. And Babylon fell in one night. And then Cyrus became the world-ruling emperor. Here you see the Medo-Persian Empire, which stretched all the way from India and into Egypt, 539 to 331 BC. Cyrus the Great's clay cylinder, you can find in the British Museum, for those of you who are interested in such things. Very fascinating history. I love history, especially when you can see the correlation of the Bible and history. It just fascinates me a lot. Anyway, this is not the end. There would be another kingdom after the Medo-Persian kingdom, according to the prophecy. A third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth. Now, which kingdom conquered Persia? Well, for those of you who study history, you know that you've heard of Alexander the Great, this great Greek monarch, Greece. In 331, he defeated the Persians. He continued in his battle. He went all the way to Afghanistan, all the way to India. And you can find a monument in India where it says, "Here Alexander the Great turned." And he went back. And 2 years after he had conquered the whole world, he died. So he did not have a lot of... He couldn't enjoy the fruits of his work, especially for any particular period of time. But he was a very famous, maybe one of the most famous generals in history. And all of Alexander's soldiers, they were clad in which metal, do you think? Well, they were brass clad. They were clad in bronze. Homer, in the Iliad, he speaks of the brass-clad Greeks. And that is very true. For those of you who know the history here, they were called the hoplites. This soldier was had a brass helmet, brass spears, brass shields. Everything was of brass. And it's quite fascinating how accurate this prophecy was. Now, some people have read this prophecy, and they think that, wow, this is too accurate. This must have been written much later. There are very good proofs to show that the book of Daniel was actually written when it is claimed to be written. We can read also one instance here. This is Flavius Josephus in Antiquities. He writes a fascinating story about Alexander the Great. It says, "When he, Alexander, went up into the temple, he magnificently treated both the high priests and the priests. And when the book of Daniel was showed him, wherein Daniel declared that one of the Greeks should destroy the empire of the Persians, he supposed that himself was the person intended." So, I believe he was true. Interesting that Alexander the Great received a Bible study from the book of Daniel, according to Josephus. Now, so we can know, both from the Dead Sea Scrolls and from the Septuagint Bible, that the book of Daniel did exist in the 300s BC, and it was already then an established book. And other details can confirm to us that it was actually written when it claims to be written. And this is amazing, because that means that three of these empires have been very accurately predicted. But it didn't end there. "A fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters everything," Daniel continues to tell Nebuchadnezzar. Now, if we compare this with history again, you will see that the kingdom that conquered Greece was the Roman Empire. In Edward Gibbon, the famous English historian, he even uses the terminology from the book of Daniel when he describes the entrance of the Roman Empire. He says, "The arms of the Republic, sometimes vanquished in battle, always victorious in war, advanced with rapid steps. And the images of gold or silver or brass that might represent the nations and their kings were successively broken by the iron monarchy of Rome." So he was a secular historian, but he sees the fulfillment of this and uses the same terminology when he speaks of the iron monarchy of Rome. That's interesting. The Romans, all of their soldiers wore iron helmets, iron shields, iron swords, not brass like the Greeks. So there's a difference here. 168 BC at the Battle of Pydna, the Roman Empire defeated the first Greek Empire and then they successively defeated the other two and took over their whole empire. Even from Scotland, at their heyday, they ruled from all the way from Scotland down to Arabia. Julius Caesar, Caesar Augustus, and all of these things. And here you have the typical Roman outfit, which is all of iron. Incidentally, it was during the reign of the Roman Empire that Christ came and was born, and he was crucified on a Roman cross. He was condemned by Pontius Pilate that was working for the Romans. The early church fathers, they noticed that this remarkable prophecy in Daniel had been fulfilled in the Roman Empire here. Hippolytus of Rome wrote in the 3rd century AD. It says, "Rejoice, blessed Daniel, thou hast not been in error. All these things have come to pass. Already the iron rules. Already it subdues and breaks all in pieces." So, throughout history, people have recognized that, yeah, something is happening here. It is being fulfilled. But what about the rest? Because this is now where we get into Brexit. So far, it's a nice history lesson. Maybe not all of you are history freaks like me. But now it gets, we come to our time. Verse 41 says, "Wherein you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. Yet the strength of the iron shall be in it. Just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay, and as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. As you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay. And in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed." All right. So what does this say? Well, let's study the toes and the feet. "Whereas you saw the feet on toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided." Now, which kingdom conquered Rome? Which is the next world-dominating power that took on the whole might of Rome and destroyed it all? Well, that's maybe a trick question. Because those of you who know history, it was not a huge empire that came and conquered Rome, right? What happened to Rome? Well, the prophecy said it would be divided. And that's exactly what happened to Rome. Rome was divided. It was not conquered, it was divided. The history tells us that you have all of these Germanic tribes, or the barbarians, as the Romans would call them, that flooded in into the empire, and they divided up the kingdom, took each a part of land, and here you have some of them. The Anglo-Saxons, the Franks, the Burgundians, the Visigoths, the Suevi, the Alemanni, the Lombards, Ostrogoths, Heruli, Vandals. Incidentally, these are 10 tribes which fit very well with these 10 toes of the statue. And these kingdoms, or these tribes, these barbarian tribes, established kingdoms that still exist today. So the Franks, which kingdom do you think they established? France, the Anglo-Saxons, England, the Alemanni. Does anyone here speak Spanish or French? Yeah. So what's the word for Germany in Spanish?
Alemania.
Alemania. Yeah. See, that's where it comes from. The Alemanni, the Visigoths in Spain, the Suevi, the Portuguese, the Burgundians, the Swiss, the Lombards, the Italians, and so on. So these are the nations of Europe, if you would, that come from this divided Roman Empire. Remember what we read in the beginning of this lost unity that Europe is trying to come back again to? That's exactly what we see here. We see this division. Some nations are strong, some nations are weak. Is that true of the European nations? It's very true. We have some strong ones, some weak ones. And they would try to unite. But up until this day, it has not succeeded. Now, I'll go with you, go through 2 minute history with you of Europe. But it is fascinating to look at all of these different rulers that try to unite Europe. Here you see the map of Europe from 1000 to 2000 AD. Now before this, you see that the Muslims in Spain, during the Islamic revolution or whatever you would call it, the Muslims, they wanted to conquer all of the world, obviously, and they were trying to conquer Europe. And so they came up through Spain here, but they were stopped, and they did not succeed in taking the entire Europe at this time. But he was not the only one that succeeded. Charlemagne in, you can see the map moving here, and that's the borders. Charlemagne, he almost, in the 8th century, he almost united Europe, but as soon as he died, it fell apart again. Then you have the Mongols. You see here, the Mongols are taking over, but they were also stopped. They did not manage to conquer Europe. You have Henry V and the Hundred Year War between England and France. You have Suleiman, who tried to conquer the whole of Europe also, and they got all the way to Vienna. But there they were stopped as well. You have Louis, the 17th of, or the 14th of France, that tried to do the same in the 1700s. I mean, you can just see this is really a mosaic of all these different kingdoms that are trying to conquer each other. Some of you have heard of Napoleon. All of you have heard of Napoleon. He tried to conquer all of Europe. Yeah, here you see Louis the 14th. He conquered Spain and so on, but then he had to come back again. Napoleon, in the end, the beginning of the 1800s, you'll see that he takes Spain and he goes up towards Russia, but he was defeated at Waterloo, and Europe remained divided. Here you see him, and he was defeated. Kaiser Wilhelm, during the First World War, attempted to also unite Europe, and you had the First World War, which did not create a united Europe, even though it was the war that was to end all wars. It did not, because you have the Second World War, then, with Hitler, and he came very close, but then he did not succeed. And now we'll get back to our story. We'll just go back to Franz Hassel. So he has presented this to all of these other people, the officers there in the hall. He thought that he was tricked. But they took off their hats, and then he gave this Bible study again. And he showed them all of these things. And he said, therefore, Hitler will not succeed. He will not be able to conquer all of Europe and unite it, because the prophecy says it cannot be done. whenever he mentioned a year or some event, he could see that this his main officer looked at all the other officers and they nodded, and when they did, there was some communication going on between them, and he was confused about what was going on. But after he gave his Bible study, the officer gave him back his Bible. He says, "Thank you very much. You can leave now. But just before you leave, let me introduce you to my colleagues here." Now, all of these people, they have been history professors before they joined the army. And they've just confirmed everything you said. So thank you very much. Now, Franz Hassel survived. And they retreated, his company retreated back to Germany. But because of this prophecy, his senior officer had put away provisions so that they could survive a retreat because of this prophecy. Because he believed in what Franz Hassel had told him, he put away all these supplies and they made it safe all the way back to Germany. So this prophecy actually saved his life and many other people's lives as well. What about today? If we go to Brexit, we see that the European Union tried to unite Europe and they failed. Why? Was it because it was a bad idea? Was it because the politicians were not smart enough? No. I believe it was because this prophecy predicted that it could not be done. And it is fascinating to me when politicians start using, unawares of this prophecy, they start using the language of the prophecy when they describe the EU. This is the Peter Eriksson from Miljöpartiet. In 2004, he said this at a party leader debate. He said, "My view is that EU has become a colossus with clay feet. Europe's leaders are bewildered when the members say no to more supranational measures, and more power to be moved farther away." Now, he's not the only one. There are many people that use this. Folkbladet, for example, they say EU has become an economic superpower, but politically speaking, it is a colossus with clay feet. It is an idiomatic expression of something big that's not stable. But that's exactly what the prophecy says, that the EU is. The divided Roman Empire would not unite, just like iron and clay cannot mix. There is only one kingdom that would rule forever, and that was the last kingdom. Daniel 2:44 said, "In the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever." From other passages in the Bible, we understand that this is when Christ returns. That is when all of the other kingdoms will be broken down. And that's the only thing in the prophecy that has not happened yet. Now, I just want us to think about this a little bit for a moment. Jesus said in John 14:29, "Now I have told you before it comes, that when it does come to pass, you may believe." Sometimes we think that faith is something unintelligible, something opposite of knowing. You either know or you have faith, and these are completely different things. Science is one thing, that's things certain, whereas faith is just this strange, blah, experience that, you know, it's not tangible. Jesus, he said that he wants us to believe based on prophecy. He says, "I'll predict you the future so that when you see that it happens, then you can believe." That was the faith that I encountered. I thought that faith was just this kind of strange, mystical experience. I just had to feel something inside of me, and that's how I became religious, you know. That's not what I encountered here. I saw that there was reasonable logic. There was clear evidence. And it demonstrated to me that the Bible has predicted the future. I mean, 2,600 years of political history, and it all happened. I presented this, I mean, when I was presented with that, I came into a dilemma. I came to this conclusion that even if I did not want the Bible to be true, I had to confess that there is something supernatural in it. I mean, who can predict 2,600 years of political history and be accurate? I presented this for atheists. I presented this for Buddhists. I presented this for Muslims. I presented this for Christians. And they all react the same way. Some people have never heard about this, these things. But the Bible has an amazing power that's very unique. And that is this ability to predict the future. And as we continue to study Bible prophecy in this series, I would challenge you to come back and to listen to these things. At least give it a try. Give it an honest chance. Perhaps you were not brought up with a Christian background. That's okay. But give it an honest chance. And see what it has to say. We will discuss tomorrow, when will Christ return? Then on Thursday, we will talk about the Antichrist revealed. You don't want to miss that one. It's basically a continuation of what we already studied, but it's Daniel chapter 7. And we'll go through, and it's even more accurate than this Daniel 2 prophecy. Then we'll talk about American Bible prophecy, and you'll be surprised. You'll be amazed. So I challenge you to come back, and I thank you so much for listening. Daniel, you can take over now.